At Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. And we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
My name's Gary Deadman. I'm the owner of Taste America, American grocery store in England.
Gary Deadman's store is in the English town of Tonbridge, about 30 miles southeast of London. He sells grocery items he imports from the U.S.
Yeah, so people like to buy pumpkin pie. They like to buy coffees. We sell a large selection of American teas, barbecue sauces, cereals, food seasonings, ice cream toppings, popcorn seasonings, marshmallows, all sorts of products.
His customers are people looking for more variety, more choice.
If you looked at an English grocery store and you was looking for coffee, you probably have a selection of 10 coffees. Now, if you go into an American store and you look down the coffee aisle, you've probably got a selection of 200. And there's all weird and crazy flavours like, you know, peppermint mocha and pumpkin spice. And we just don't get that here. We get regular coffee. We might get a hazelnut. You're very lucky to see something like a French vanilla.
But some large economic forces have been hurting his business.
When we import our products from the USA, we're being hit by, first of all, the cost of the goods out of the USA, the inflationary costs, going up about 15 to 25% on groceries. Then we have the added cost of the shipping, which has gone through the roof because, one, we pay in dollars for the shipping. The shippers have also got high cost of oil at the moment. And then on top of that, just this year, we're losing 20% on the exchange rate of the pound versus the dollar.
That's what a surging dollar on the currency exchange markets means for Gary, a drop in the value of the British pound.
Say, for example, we're bringing something in like commercial Crisco oils, which may have cost us like $10. The costs have gone up about 25% in the US, so they're now about $12.50. Now, if you add in the exchange rate drop, instead of us paying around $12 with the exchange rate before, we're probably paying about 14 to 15.
Worse, in hard times, he can't pass the increased costs on to his customers. If he did, they'd just go back to plain old English coffee and somehow get through fall without a pumpkin pie spice latte. So the strong dollar is cutting deep into his profits. Meanwhile, Gary is looking to the holidays and wanting nothing more than a better exchange rate, which today is at $1.11 to the pound.
We're hoping we can get through to Christmas. We have a strong Christmas, we hope. And then we're hoping that you work out the average of the dollar over the last sort of like 10 years, probably been around 150 to the pound. So we'd like to get back to those sort of numbers. And I'm sure there's a lot of companies in the US that are probably struggling as well because of the drop in their sales exporting. So it's a double-edged sword.
That was Gary Deadman, owner of Taste America, a grocery store in Tunbridge in southeast England. I'm Kimberly Atkinstor, in for Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. This hour we'll be talking about the soaring value of the U.S. dollar, why it's happening, and why that is not just hurting small businesses like Gary Deadman's, but wreaking havoc on economies around the world. Joining me now from New York is Kenneth Rogoff. He's chair of international economics at Harvard University and former chief economist at the International Monetary Fund. Ken, welcome to On Point.
Thank you.
So first, let's start at the beginning. Why is the U.S. dollar surging right now?
Well, I think it's a combination of a few reasons. One, of course, is the world's a very unsafe place right now. There's the war in Ukraine, China saber-rattling across the Taiwan Straits. And whenever that happens, the U.S. is the safest haven. Second, obviously, we are raising interest rates fiercely, and other countries are lagging behind. So when we raise interest rates, it makes investing in the U.S. more attractive to everybody. So money flows in out of other countries into the U.S. And last, maybe not so obvious, but if you look at Europe and Japan, they are big importers of food, energy. They're not self-sufficient in those things. We are. It's true, the consumers are losing, but the producers are winning, and overall it benefits the dollar.
So the dollar is strong, which could in some ways be good news for Americans in particular. But we are also dealing here in America and around the world with inflation. Talk a little bit about that interplay between inflation and a strong dollar.
Well, inflation is the reason that our central bank is raising interest rates so fast. And that's part of what's driving up the dollar for sure. And I think Gary, the English importer, he was great, by the way. He covered everything I could possibly say. But he made the point that when he's importing something, the price was going up in dollars anyway. We have in foods, anyone who goes to the grocery store knows the price of things is up 10%. If you're lucky, 30%. He was giving numbers like that. And then on top of that, the pound has plummeted. That's the British currency, has plummeted against the dollar, and that adds to its his costs. Everyone imports oil almost, except for a few countries, and we think the oil price is high. But for example, the Japanese yen has gone down by almost a third against the dollar. So on top of the oil prices, which they have to import, it's not just pumpkin lattes, they have to pay this extra 30%. So just on that side, it's brutal.
So talk a little bit about the Fed. The Fed has raised interest rates in an effort to try to cool off inflation. How is it the fact that they've raised interest rates that are causing this problem with the uneven currency? Is it the timing of the interest rate? Sort of talk a little bit more about how the rising interest rates affect the value of the dollar.
So until relatively recently, interest rates across the world were in a coma. They were just zero or near zero, and it was the same everywhere. And actually, exchange rates weren't moving around that much for maybe the 5 or 6 years running into well into the pandemic. But then suddenly, we have all these things going on, but you ask about inflation. The U.S. got hit first, although at this point, Europe is as bad or worse. And so the Federal Reserve started raising interest rates. We have a stronger economy. And so when the Federal Reserve raises interest rates, it obviously hurts home prices, it hurts stock prices, it hurts consumers, it hurts pretty much everybody except lenders. And we have a strong economy that can take it at least better than Europe and the UK. So one of the reasons they're slower than us is that their economies are much weaker. I mean, they're right next door to Ukraine. They're feeling the high energy and food prices even more than we are. So there are all these things, the dollar sort of the pulse of the global economy.
Yeah. And talk a little bit more about how that it impacts the U.S. dollar. You mentioned that when there's turmoil in the rest of the world, the U.S. dollar is a safe investment. Explain that a little bit more.
Well, you know, historically, currencies have seemed safe, and then suddenly the country loses a war and it's not safe. Now, we're not quite talking about that. But if you're thinking of investing in Germany, and now let's not talk about buying German government bonds, but building a plant, it's a little scarier with what's going on next door. You don't quite know where things are going. It's a little safer investing in the U.S. The world is worse. We're all worse off, but it hits Europe more. And you could turn to Japan. They're next door to China. Everybody's watching the People's Congress and the, you know, what President Xi is doing to take tighter and tighter control and saying he wants to exert more superpower, build the military. All of those things, they're not good, but it's worse for others than the United States.
Yeah. And so why aren't we seeing, we're talking about how the United States, we're raising interest rates here to address inflation. Other countries are not doing the same thing. Why is that?
Well, they are, but at a slower pace. Because the trouble is, if the problem's just that you had inflation, fine, you raise interest rates. It's straightforward. But it's not. In much of the world, and perhaps soon in the U.S., you have inflation, really high inflation, like we haven't seen since the 70s, and the world's going into recession. So as you raise interest rates, it cools the economy, but the economy's already too cold, so you're sort of lost either way. And the other countries are in worse shape in their recessionary tendencies at the moment. We may get there. So they're more tempered by the fact that their economies are weaker. They are raising rates, but just not as fast.
And you said that the United States has a stronger economy, can weather these types of things better than other countries. But if you're, you know, we're talking about people in the United States who are feeling inflation, they may not, not that they don't agree, but they are unsure how well the United States is weathering this. And one point is the rising cost of exports, just as we discussed earlier. That's one place where U.S. companies are getting hit. Talk about that.
Oh, goodness. This isn't good for us. This is the extremely difficult and dangerous situation. The dollar versus the euro is just like, who's worse off? But no, it's a very difficult situation for Americans. First of all, for exporters, it makes our stuff more expensive that compared to buying local goods for almost anywhere else. It's also the case, you know, if you think about tourists coming to the United States, I have friends coming from places like Switzerland and Japan, which I traditionally think of so expensive when I go. They're coming here and saying, oh, it's so expensive, I can't believe it, because they're looking at their, you know, they're thinking in Swiss francs or they're thinking in Japanese yen, and they're just not worth as much. And so there are many, many ways that hits. And I should add one other point is a lot of American companies earn funds abroad, and the profits are now worth less in dollars.
That's a good point. Thanks for bringing that up. We are talking about the U.S. dollar and why its value has soared around the world and why that may be a dangerous thing. When we come back, we'll look back to 1985, when the dollar had soared like today, and what the world's major economies did to stop it. I'm Kimberly Atkins-Store. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Kimberly Atkins-Store. I've been speaking with Ken Rogoff, Chair of International Economics at Harvard University and former Chief Economist at the International Monetary Fund. And we're talking about the soaring value of the U.S. dollar and what that means for the global economy. I'd like to bring in another guest to this conversation. Joining us from Paris is Jean-Claude Trichet, former president of the European Central Bank and former governor of the Bank of France. Thank you so much for joining us, Jean-Claude.
It's a pleasure, Kimberly. Real pleasure.
So as we mentioned before, there was a time in 1985 when the U.S. dollar was soaring as it is today, and it was much stronger against European currencies, and that led to something called the Plaza Accord. Can you explain to us what that was?
Yes, certainly. Well, what happened at the time in a floating exchange system where we still are after the explosion of the Bretton Woods arrangement, we had a dollar which was picking up and up and up and up under the more or less the same, I would say, causes that were mentioned by Ken a moment ago. The main issue was at the time the necessity for Paul Volcker, the Federal Reserve, and the U.S. administration to regain control of inflation, which had been pushed higher, higher, and higher with the first oil shock of 1993, and the second oil shock. Both oil shock were extremely violent and created a period of extremely high inflation during, I would say, practically all the period of the 90s. And then at the beginning of the 80s, one had to recontrol the system, which was totally out of order. Paul Volcker was at the helm of the central bank, and he increased rates massively. When we are speaking of high interest rates today, it's almost nothing in comparison with what the Fed had to do to regain control of inflation. And what was absolutely impressive at the time, I'm speaking of the 80s, end of the 70s, beginning of the 80s. And at that time, clearly, the interest rates differential was so strong, and the determination of the U.S. to regain control of inflation was so visible that you had, at that time, of course, an immense surge of the U.S. dollar. A surge which is even more important, was more important than today. If I compare the Reagan dollar of that period of time and the Carter dollar previously, expressed in terms of European currencies, the proportion was 1-3, so an immense surge of the U.S. dollar. And this was considered at the beginning by the U.S. administration as something which was more or less a vote of confidence on the U.S. because the dollar was so strong. It was the appreciation, I would say, of market participants and. But of course, the consequence, the adverse consequences of this very high dollar seen by the entire community, and particularly in the U.S., was such that the administration and the Fed was pushing for that, decided to try to regain control of the exchange rates themselves. And this was the very cause of this accord, which was a big change, if I may, of the U.S. policy under the, I would say, influence of James Baker, the Secretary of the Treasury.
And so, what happened? We had the leaders, the economic leaders from countries around the world met in New York, and what happened? Did we lose Jean-Claude Trichet? Well, I'm going to turn to you, Ken, to talk a little bit about this Plaza Accord. What was the motivating factor that brought all of these world leaders together to try to come up with an agreement to address the economy at the time?
So there was a lot of pressure coming from U.S. manufacturers and exporters. Imagine if you were trying to sell Ford cars abroad, and Jean-Claude Trichet, who, by the way, is one of the fathers of the euro, is absolutely important person in Europe. But it was very hard. Or if you were selling wheat or anything, it got really hard. And so the manufacturers had been complaining to the Reagan administration, and as Jean-Claude Trichet said, in the first Reagan administration, the one that, through his 1980, 1984, they just said, oh, the market loves us. And, and finally they conceded this was really hurting American firms, and they tried to see what to do about it. And there were so-called G5 group of countries, Germany, France, United Kingdom, Japan, and the United States, got together. I think it was actually at the Plaza Hotel in New York, and I think it's on September 22nd, 1985, and they cut a deal. Now, a lot of things building up to that. And the idea was they would try to use other measures to bring down the dollar. They'd keep letting U.S. interest rates be high. They wouldn't change that, but they would try to change their own portfolios to sell dollars, basically, and buy their own currencies. And it worked. It worked for a while. It is true, like, maybe the dollar had gotten so high it was going to go down anyway. We'll never know. But it's considered one of the great successes of international economic policies. just like the way I think you hear often people talk about the Marshall Plan after World War II, where the U.S. generously gave money to Europe. Everybody says, you know, what a model of international cooperation. In at least the technocrat world, the Plaza Accords considered, wow, we pulled it off. We did the impossible. It's been hard to repeat it.
Yeah, Jean-Claude Trichet is back with us. Jean-Claude, do you think that the Plaza Accord worked?
Yes, indeed. I share the view of Ken. The Plaza worked to the extent that the main message was no further rise of the dollar, first, and second, let the dollar go down. And when you look at the 1 year and a half after the Plaza Agreement, it is exactly what you see. And of course, in my opinion, it was due to many factors. Of course, the fact that there was a consensus amongst the five that had negotiated that accord, and that consensus was clear in the eyes of all economic agents and market participants. Second, there was a very clear beginning of the fundamentals backing this, because we had interest rates going higher in the other countries, and it was clear that as far as the U.S. was concerned, the Fed had no intention to continue to go very high. So there was some kind of, I would say, concordance between what was said and what was done. And of course, and it is important also, as said Ken, there was a risk taken by all parties concerned, namely selling the dollar for some, purchasing their own currency for the others. And all this, of course, has created, in my opinion, the capacity to have a success, as it was clear. The success, in my opinion, in such a period of time, relies upon four conditions. First, a real consensus between all the partners concerned, governments and central banks. Second, a clear message, a message of the type no further rise of currency X or no further decline of currency Y. A third condition would be, of course, no contradiction between what was said and told to market participants, investors, and savers, and the fundamentals, the policies pursued by the various countries concerned and central banks concerned. And last, interventions, even if symbolic, to credibilize the message, to tell the market participants, we are ourselves members of the G7 or G5 or whatever, taking a risk that credibilized our message. And the Plaza was a big success, but I would also list the Louvre Agreement in 87, which was also an accord with a very clear message. Around current levels, exchange rates are more or less okay. So it was a clear message to stabilize the dollar, which was falling down like a stone. And then we had a number of other recently, only very rare such agreements. Whether or not it would be time to have another such agreement is an open question, of course.
Well, that was going to be my next question to you. Do you think that something like the Plaza Accord could happen today? First of all, would other countries be willing to participate? And if so, would it work?
Well, my understanding that it is possible. Even if the dollar has been against the euro, for instance, even higher in the past. We are at a point in 98. We were at times at 0.95 or something. So, and we, of course, activated at that time such an agreement. It was in year 2000 in Prague. There was a G7 communique, more or less saying no further decline of the euro. Now, whether we will have an agreement to say no further rise of the dollar is an open question, but we are not that far, in my opinion, from a consensus of all the party concerns. The parties concerned are the floating currencies that are member of the basket of the SDR. So you have the sterling, you have the euro, the dollar, and the sterling, and with these currencies, we could have an agreement, in my opinion. I don't exclude that. I don't say it's easy because, again, it has to work. If it doesn't work, it's a catastrophe for the credibility of the authorities, of the governments, and of the central bank. So the condition for success, again, are a real consensus without, real thoughts. That would be obvious in the eyes of the market, a clear message. Of course, policy is going in the direction of what would be suggested to markets, and interventions to credibilize the message. We are not necessarily far from such an agreement, but of course, the conditions are very, very important. And if you miss the condition, you lose your credibility, and it is the worst outcome you could imagine.
Jean-Claude Trichet is a former president of the European Central Bank and former governor of the Bank of France. Thank you so much for your time and for joining us on Point.
It was a pleasure.
Ken Rogoff, do you think that a Plaza Accord type agreement could work today? Could it happen? And if it does happen, B, would it work?
Well, Jean-Claude Trichet thinks it is possible, and he helped do it. He certainly played an important role. He wasn't at the Plaza Hotel, but he was already very high in France and involved. And if, he says he thinks it can work, I mean, I think that's interesting. I think there are a couple things pushing back against it. So one is that the emerging markets have gotten a lot more important. So they used to be a much smaller share of the global economy. Now they're more than half, maybe 60%. So just having a deal among the rich countries doesn't do the job anymore. Second, the markets have gotten a lot bigger. That's, certainly makes it harder to do intervention. And third, central banks have become much more independent. So actually in 1985, hardly any countries had really independent central banks. You could tell the central bank what to do. And now they almost all do, and they really care about inflation. So what if you're telling them to do something that's going to stabilize the dollar but might make inflation in their country worse? But it is true, we have not seen the dollar by any measure as high since 1985. It's just stunning. And if it continues to rise, I do think they will look to do something.
So we've talked about how the strong dollar can be a disadvantage to Americans, particularly small business, those who are exporting. There's an upside for some folks as well. I discovered when I was shopping online that if I shopped at Selfridges, the same item was considerably cheaper than it was on the websites of American department stores. And also, Ramsey Caldwell is from Pittsburgh, and he's currently traveling in Portugal. American tourists like him are getting a huge boost from the strong dollar.
We've been talking about this. I'm traveling with my partner and one of our friends who's from Canada, and their dollar is not as strong against the euro right now. And so me and my partner are just, we don't have to convert really the price. It's like 1 euro to $1. And it just feels like everything is so cheap. We just keep saying, oh my gosh, it's so cheap. Whereas my friend from Canada, she's having to convert in her head. And I mean, she's converting back to Canadian dollars. She thinks it's still a decent deal, but she's not as excited as we are about, for us, it's like everything's 20% off basically.
So talk a little bit about that, the upside for Americans.
Well, as consumers, it's great. You can buy things from abroad cheaper than you could before. It doesn't necessarily get passed through to the consumer right away. So, Kimberly, you picked that example. You had to go do it for yourself. Your local store wasn't doing it. You had to check a British store. But that's going to take place over time for everybody. And of course, if you're traveling abroad, it just almost anywhere you can just, throw a dart at the map, and it's going to be way cheaper than it was before. So absolutely, there's upsides to it. I mean, on the whole, although there are ways it hurts us, it hurts other countries more. The ones that hurts the most in our country are, businesses, people who work at companies that are trying to export stuff.
Yeah. So what about foreign exporters to the U.S.? Does that work out to be a benefit to them?
Yeah, it eventually it does. So they price everything in dollars, but eventually it does. I wanted to just bring in one other point that's really sure. bad for the rest of the world, which is that almost a very large share of debt, for example, even if a French company borrows from China, is denominated in dollars. It's stunning. And so when the dollar goes up, it makes it more expensive to repay those debts. And that really hurts some countries, especially emerging markets.
I'm going to pause you right there. I'm Kimberly Akin-Store, and we're talking to Ken Rogoff of Harvard University and former chief economist at the International Monetary Fund. And up next, we'll talk about why the U.S. dollar has soared against other currencies around the world and what more it means for the global economy. This is On Point. I'm Kimberly Akin-Store.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Seen. Listen and follow Last Seen wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Kimberly Akin-Store. My guest today is Ken Rogoff, an expert in international economics, a professor at Harvard University, and former chief economist at the International Monetary Fund. And we are talking about the soaring U.S. dollar, and I want to talk now about what it means about the global economy. Ken, I wanted to talk about the global economic and geopolitical implications of that, but I think a good place to start is where you left off before the break, talking about debt and the way the soaring dollar affects debt. Can you talk a little more about that?
So there are two things hitting really hard at debt. One is the soaring interest rates, because when the U.S. raises its interest rate, it puts pressure on everybody else to raise their interest rate, and they have their own inflation too. And then second, the dollar is the world currency. And it's not that everything's in dollars, but a lot of global debt, particularly international debt, when Australia corporation wants to borrow from anywhere, it actually has to do it in U.S. dollars, not Australian dollars, with maybe a couple exceptions. It's true for Africa. It's true for South Asia. Everybody has to borrow in dollars. I'm slightly exaggerating, but only slightly. So when the dollar goes up by 25 and 30%, you're still earning your money in local currency, a lot of it. And so it makes your debt riskier, and then creditors charge you more for that. So a period like this, which is very much like the mid-80s, the Plaza Accord we were talking about earlier, where the interest rates are soaring, the dollar is soaring. We had the developing country debt crisis in the 80s. It was a period of a decade of no growth in Latin America and some other emerging markets around the world. And there's sort of a fear that on top of all the difficulties we're facing geopolitically, the pandemic, this could explode. And I mean, everybody's very attuned to it. We've seen this movie before. We don't want to have it happen, but it's not so easy to manage.
And another thing that is generally denominated in the U.S. dollar is oil and gas. Can you talk about the impact on that on the world economy and here at home?
Well, for us, it's denominated in dollars, energy. So we feel when the oil price goes up, but we're not feeling anything on top of that. But other places, take India, imports a lot of its oil. And when the price goes up, on top of that, its exchange rates depreciated quite a bit. I could get into that's part of why they haven't been cooperating on not importing oil from Russia. It's a very poor country. They feel desperate. And a lot of African countries feel that way. They say, you're telling us not to import Russian oil, but we're desperate. The price for us is absolutely something we can't pay.
And it's happening at a time where that dangerous things are happening, including the war in Ukraine, which is leading to that push for an embargo on oil imported from Russia. There's also a global food supply crisis happening as well. Talk about how some of these external factors feed into this inequality between the strength of the U.S. dollar and other currencies.
Well, of course, the U.S. is, I think, the biggest exporter of wheat. So the price of all food's gone up. We all know that. Just go to your local bakery and they've had to raise the price because their inputs have all gone up, flour and wheat. But for other countries who are importing from us or even from our competitors who are matching our prices, they have to also pay the exchange rate on top of that. Most commodities in the world, in other words, things like foods, metals, everything, almost everything's priced in dollars. The prices are very high, and they're getting the double whammy of the exchange rate. And of course, some of these countries, many of the people of the world, like the vast majority, live in very poor countries where they depend on some imports of dollar goods, and they're being brutalized. They're already in really desperate straits in many developing economies, and we're starting to see some of the ramifications, even with, say, Sri Lanka defaulting. I think a lot of people notice it seemed to be doing fine, but it's feeling many of these effects.
So one question that we tend to ask economists like you is whether or not we are in or heading into a recession here in the United States. Are there other countries that you think are heading into or are already in a recession, such as China?
So Europe is headed full steam into a recession because it has inflation, it has the war at its border, people are very reluctant to invest. They're in the worst shape, perhaps. But China's in terrible shape also. I don't know if we have real numbers, and there's a lot of attention to the People's Congress now. But they have, first of all, their zero COVID policies crushing the economy, but they have terrible real estate problems. It's not exactly like we had in 2008, but in some ways it's worse. And so they're in their equivalent of a recession. And all of that makes it harder for us to resist being in recession because, yes, we're the most important economy in the world, but those are big players in demand for our goods. So I think the risks of the U.S. heading into a recession are extremely high. I mean, not quite 100%. I would never say I'm sure of anything, but they're very high. But what really worries me is we might get a very bad recession, which I just can't imagine dealing with that now after the pandemic, after the financial crisis. I'm very concerned that our policymakers are focusing too much on inflation and not enough on the risk of a really bad recession.
And so if we are in danger of recession, other countries as well are heading in that direction. This sounds like this could have the makings of a really global financial meltdown. I mean, you mentioned the crisis in 2008 that we felt. How might a more worldwide meltdown of financial systems impact everyone?
Because of the experience after 2008, the good news is there's been a lot of regulation that protects certain parts of the financial sector. There's been more caution from some emerging markets. So, you know, it's not all doom and gloom. But on the other hand, I think some of your listeners are surely following the circus going on in the UK, where the prime minister is the shortest prime minister. Frankly, part of what hit her was when interest rates are rising, it pointed to some weaknesses in the plumbing of the British financial system. I'm not trying to say Liz Truss did a great job, but actually it wasn't all her fault. The rising interest rates exposed this problem with the pensions. And I don't get into the detail on that, but it's the kind of weird corner you didn't know the rock was there until something happened. And when interest rates start rising, and they're not just rising, they're rising really fast. The 10-year interest rate in the U.S., which is the bellwether of the global financial system, it's what determines in many ways your car loan, your mortgage, everything, is at the highest it's been since before the financial crisis. And it's hitting everybody. So it's absolutely a concern. On the other hand, inflation's really high. My own take, which is a little out of consensus among economists, most of them are just saying quash inflation, there's nothing worse. I think there is something worse, and having a really deep recession. And I have been urging taking a little slower pace, not saying we're not going to bring inflation down, but maybe not racing ahead quite as breathlessly as we've been doing.
So right now here in the United States, the Fed is set to raise rates by 0.75, according to the Wall Street Journal. They're debating the size of future hikes. We're heading into winter. So if other nations, particularly if they raise their interest rates, might this settle down the soaring dollar? Might it help address inflation here and abroad and give the United States and other nations some relief?
Well, certainly, if other countries raise their interest rates, that would weaken the dollar because it would make their currencies more competitive and make it more attractive to invest in those countries. But the value of the dollar is not the only thing in life either. When they have much weaker economies, I particularly point at Europe. However we're feeling the effects of the war in Ukraine, it's much worse there. And their economies, and also, of course, you know, I'm sure your listeners are following what's going on to gas prices in Germany, et cetera. And so they just don't have a lot of room to raise their interest rates so sharply because their economies are already in recession. People have forgotten that we can have a shock that makes output go down and inflation go up at the same time, because it's been a long time since the 70s that's happened. But we're in that world. You're in a Hobson's choice. There's just no magical thing to do. Right now, the central banks particularly are saying inflation, we've got to stop it. And if you look at the inflation, it's crazy. I mean, I was looking at the inflation that they're predicting the IMF for the UK next year, and I thought it was a typo. It was so big. But that said, it's not the only thing in life. It's a difficult situation. You have to balance these risks.
So could this lead to political instability? I mean, we talked a little bit about what's happening in the UK as a direct result of financial woes. Could we see instability in other European countries?
Well, I really appreciate that you asked that, because that's exactly what worries me about having a deep recession, and not just in other European countries, in the United States or in China. It's one thing to have a deep recession. It happens. It's another thing to have one right on top of having the pandemic, which was not that long after the financial crisis. The financial crisis of 2008, 2009, and the pandemic, those were the worst recessions since the Great Depression of the 1930s. And then to have something on top, of course it leads to political changes. Of course it leads. I believe some of the divisiveness in our country and around the world traces to having these deep recessions. I think having another one right now, it would be very unpredictable. I'm not a political scientist, but it absolutely concerns me.
So what tools are there available to stave off some of these potential negative outcomes from the current financial situation. You were skeptical of another Plaza Accord, but what can countries do individually or collectively that they still haven't done yet that could address this?
So I think short term, one thing they can do is target fiscal policy more effective. Part of the reason there's so much inflation is we were worried the pandemic would go on forever and fiscal policy came in too big for too long. And it sort of spread to everyone. That's the way politics works. It really needs to be smaller and more targeted on the neediest people. So that's certainly one thing. And the International Monetary Fund, where I used to work, has been emphatically making that point. Secondly, there is this tactical decision, which I've talked about with the central banks. I won't repeat it again about, you know, how to trade off. And then I think, I don't think we're ready for the conversation right now, but back in the 70s, the answer was, on top of doing things to improve inequality and lower inflation and everything else, you had to find ways to make your economy work better, to make it more efficient. That's become a dirty word over the last 10 or 15 years. People associate it with neoliberalism. And I'm not saying there weren't some wrong things and a lot of mistakes made. But at the end of the day, if we're facing China shrinking, energy prices higher, more war in the world, there are no easy answers that we're worse off. If you want to mitigate that, then you have to kind of, you know, think of things like, for example, antitrust policy. Could we make that more effective? I mean, I know that's fraught, that point, but I'd start the simple thing is you have to target expenditures at people who most need it.
And so give us a best case scenario. Say some of these things can be implemented. What might the world economy look like in 6 months' time or a year's time? Best case scenario, what do you think?
So the good news is Carmen Reinhart and I, in our book This Time is Different in 2009, studied seven centuries, many, many debt crises, financial crises, inflation crises. And you know what? They all end. So you get in this mentality that it will go on forever. It won't. So, but you know, exactly what that time frame will be, I think it could be a wild ride. But I'm actually, I know it doesn't sound like it, quite optimistic about how we will reorient and reorganize ourselves and, you know, come back better. But I think 2023 is going to be a tough year. Inflation's going to stay high. Much of the world and probably the United States will be in recession. I just hope it's only a mild one and that we come out of it stronger.
And the opposite outcome would be some sort of
you don't even
stagnation.
Want to know. Well, I mean, obviously the biggest problem really is not the economy, you know, not economic, it's geopolitical. So what happens with Russia and Ukraine, China and Taiwan? I will say of doing this for years, it's rare when that's the most important thing, but right now it is.
Kenneth Rogoff is chair of international economics at Harvard University and former chief economist at the International Monetary Fund and author of The Curse of Cash. And This Time is Different. Ken, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me, Kimberly.
I'm Kimberly Atkins-Store. This is On Point.